seven, six, five.
Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today's what, the eighth day of May, of April. I wish it was May. It's now about 10 minutes after the hour of 8 a.m. Have Senator Guess, Senator Terrio, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins, and we've all checked to make sure that our cell phones are turned off today. And I think
donuts,
Senator. You know, at the end of the bar, at the end of the bar, in some of these places, they have a bell, and if it rings, you know, everybody gets a free drink.
I'd be more than happy to buy the committee a donut, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, generally, it's the new Alaska bell is the cell phone, and if it rings, you buy lunch for the rest of the people.
I said donut, Mr. Chairman.
Well, only those of us who have had it happen can truly appreciate.
Duty just calls.
It just happens. But okay, well, where we were yesterday, we were talking about some of the labor and commerce issues. We've got through amendment number 4, which passed. We tabled a couple of amendments into the day. We asked for additional amendments. There were a great number of additional amendments that came towards us. Here's kind of how I would like to take a look at all the huge. There were some people that asked if they could testify today, and earlier, as you remember, we said testimony on from this point forward would be related to possible amendments or in response to amendments, but would be constructive regarding the markup of the bill. And we I'm not really entertaining any additional people that want to talk about how the system worked for them or didn't work for them, and I have had some requests for that, and at this point I'm still going to stick to the fact that we're in the markup phase on this bill, and we will talk about the amendments and the possible changes. Now, I did get last night, for everyone's benefit, a so-called compromise bill. I don't know what that means, a compromise bill, except that it was a bill that was sent to us by Mr. Constantino. When I looked through it, and we can hand that out, Brian, if you'd like. As I looked through it last night, it wasn't particularly the section numberings were scattered around. I think it wasn't. I don't know if they'd had time to complete it the way that they'd like to have tried to do it. And the only form that I saw in that that amendment that process was they suggested that we freeze insurance rates to the 2004 rate and for the next 3 years. And just as a way of comment, Ms. Hall, could I get you to come up for a second?
Mr. Chairman, after Ms. Hall comes up and addresses us. I know we left off yesterday, and Senator Guess indicated she was working an amendment, which
yep,
we've got. Just before we start shuffling the paper here, if we could just number hers.
Okay.
And whatnot, just so
Let's find that. First, so far I've got number 5 is the one that's...
next up, right?
Next up. That starts out with page 26, following line 23. Number 6 we tabled, which says... page 15, following line 3. 7 is G1 by Craver. 8 is G2 by Craver. 9 starts with page 23, line 6, following this chapter. We also have one that's pending that we had the other day. Came from Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce. This one,
Which one?
Which, this longer one that said Section 17. We're going to number it now.
Okay.
We're going to make this number 10. This will be number 10. And do we have the one that came from Gretchen also, Brian?
I handed it out to your office.
Yeah, he's got it.
Yeah.
He's got it here.
Okay.
It's going to be 11.
We've got so much paper, we want to make sure. We'll make that 11.
And then the conceptual amendment from Labor and Commerce that came.
Well, I got to look, let me look at that because I got to remember.
And then I have, did someone get one from Jeff Logan?
Have you got Gretchen's over there, Brian?
Jeff Logan.
Or Senator Guesses, I should say.
First names. It's two, number six.
D.5 will be amendment, proposed amendment number 11. Let's look at that one, Brian, of, as soon as you're, want to give him enough time to make sure he's got this in his in the proper places. And Johnny Ellis sent to us.
Number 12.
I want to take a look at it and see if I remember it. We'll number it number 12 and see if I remember it.
Number
12, we'll make that, which is G.4. Have you got that? We'll get you one. That'll be number 12.
So it's a conceptual amendment passed.
I think we did. We kind of discussed that a little bit already, though, didn't we?
We discussed the concept in 12.
Yeah.
And whether or not there was something that actually did pass or if it was discussed in Labor and Commerce about the conflict of interest.
And we'd call that 12.
And then delete, insert, delete, insert. Okay, if we do, and then add it. We're still at. Did we need to go, weren't we defining attending physician to deal with the issue in Section 24 that said prescribing physician?
We're going to change that word.
Okay.
That will be an amendment we'll have to do.
Okay. And then can we go re...
I have that set up to do here.
Okay, so we...
We'll get through that, hopefully. Remind me, but that will come down to... That's a note I have on the bill.
Okay. Because then we're not solving that problem.
Can you set these extras here on your table?
All right.
Thank you, Judy.
Okay. We'll just leave those there unnumbered for now.
Okay.
Put in a bill for that $24 million.
Okay. Miss Hall, we've got through 12 here ready to go, but I need to ask a couple of questions just so that we know how to go forward here.
I was trying to stay in the back.
We appreciate your attendance.
Didn't Paul come to the table?
Ms. Hall, you might give her a copy of this, Brian.
Is that...
That's long. One of the... suggestions that was forwarded to us in a 20-some page document was that as a matter of being able to save money in the workers' comp system, that there was a proposal that the legislature freeze both the medical benefits and the insurance premiums. Could you tell me what practical effect that would have on the premiums?
Yes, Senator Seekins. I don't want to make my comments and have them interpreted as alarmist or that anyone has made comments to me about that concept. So what I'm going to say is what I think really would be the practical effects of that. The idea of the premium rate filings, as I described those in some detail the other day, is the largest component of insurance premium is the analysis of expected claims cost. And we look at those claims cost and approve, disapprove, request modification of those loss costs based on the data provided to us. If, in fact, those loss costs and premiums, which include other components, were frozen, I think what we would see would be withdrawals of markets from Alaska. We have not had a good track record in terms of even break even in the workers' compensation line. It's been a losing line of business for a number of years. And if an insurance company can't at least cover their expenditure costs, I have a difficult time imagining they would stay in business in our state. The practical effect of having companies withdraw from our markets would be, one, certainly there would be no then voluntary market for which to have employers obtain coverage for their mandatory workers' compensation benefits. If there were no companies willing to write coverage here, we would then also have a secondary effect on our current assigned risk pool. The assigned risk pool, as we've discussed before, is funded first through premiums. If there is a deficit created by higher claims costs than premiums taken in, that deficit is sent back as an assessment on insurance companies. If there are no, and it's based on your market share. So if you have a 10% market share, you pay 10% of that deficit. If you're not there anymore and you don't have a market share, we would have no one to pass that cost to. Therefore, the assigned risk pool would also fold, which would leave no viable market for employers to purchase coverage for their statutory obligations. I think at that point it would necessitate, and I think I mentioned this the other day, one of two options. One, we either don't make workers' compensation mandatory anymore, so there would be no protection in the system, or two, we establish some type of a state fund, and I don't think that could happen overnight, so to speak, particularly between now and the end of, you know, whenever that legislation would become effective.
And even if the state did establish a fund and it froze the rates to no higher than what had been approved for 2004 through June 30th of 2007, would the state have to, you think the state would have to subsidize the system?
Well, something would.
Wouldn't be the
premium. If the rates were frozen, I have no reason to believe that there would be a fund that could cover the increase in cost of claims, and I don't know where that balance would come from.
But assuming that we were able to take costs, we may have the same practical effect in terms of the premium.
I'm not sure.
If we're able to contain costs.
If you're able to contain costs.
We may have the same practical effect in not seeing our premiums go higher. And
that's correct.
So premiums are more reactive as far as the
premiums are reflective of costs.
Thank you. Any other questions on that matter? Thank you very much, Ms. Hull. May need you as we go farther down the line. We also have a number, I should take a look at the others. We have three more amendments that I'd like to number this morning as well. Right. These were brought to us by Alaska State Medical Association. And so we'll take the first one, which Brian will send out. We'll make that number 13. we just go off the record for a minute while we hand these out? We're back on the record.
Oh, Brian, that was the extra one I had.
Extra
one.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. Our primary goal today is to get the amendments that are sponsored by the members of the committee out of the way first and foremost. So let's go. Just for the record, we have passed Amendment Number 1. We have passed Amendment Number 2. We have passed Amendment Number 3. We have passed Amendment Number 4. We have tabled Amendment Number 5. Let's talk about Amendment Number 5. Amendment Number 5, is there a motion to take it from the table for reconsideration? Senator French has moved to
untable
the motion, and it's now under consideration without objection. Mr. Lisanki, have you had an opportunity to examine this amendment?
Pardon me. For the record, my name is Paul F. Lisanki. I'm the Director of Division of Workers' Compensation within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I've looked at this proposed amendment a little bit more since the meeting yesterday, and I think that my original comments are, I would stand by my original comments about how the amendment would function and what it would do.
Questions for Mr. Lisanki? Senator French?
Or perhaps for anyone who might have some information about this. My question would be, how many claims would this affect? How many folks who are bring claims having aggravated, accelerated, or injured themselves and re-inflamed, if you will, a pre-existing condition? How many of those folks are we talking about? How many injuries will not get compensated should we adopt this amendment?
Senator French, through the chair, because this is a new provision, which is not something that's functional right now, our system has never been set up to try and make a distinction between injuries that are new injuries and injuries that are aggravations or accelerations or combinations. So I really cannot give you any kind of a number that's associated with any kind of real data.
Thank you.
Questions on Amendment Number 5? Okay, let's move for consideration of Amendment Number 6. Take it off the table. Motion to take it off the table.
I'll do that.
Senator French has moved to remove the Amendment Number 6 from the table for consideration. Without objection, it's now under consideration. Any comments, Mr. Lisanki, that you make on Number 6?
Similar to what I just said about Amendment Number 5, Mr. Chairman, I believe that my initial comments about how this would function were correct. The only thing I would like to make an additional comment is I believe the chair had asked some questions about how might this change affect someone who had, say, a very bad injury and had what might be referred to as chronic intractable pain, really terrible pain. And I think my original comment might have misled you. I mean, I'm not absolutely certain how a claim for palliative care, I mean, in my mind, that would be different than palliative care. But if you wanted to be certain of that, you might want to make a small change to this proposed amendment that put in black and white that palliative care was not intended, the restriction on palliative care was not intended to restrict treatment for intractable pain.
Okay. Do you have any kind of language that you might suggest on that?
Mr. Chairman, am I the only one who had an amendment dropped off? Someone dropped off an amendment.
Amendment
to this amendment on that topic?
I don't remember if I saw it or not, Senator, I guess, but let's take a look and see what you've got.
While we're doing that, is Mr. Jordan on the line?
Mr. Jordan is on the line, so we'll be able to talk with him if you want. Let's just take a look. Limitations described in this section do not apply in the event that the physician certifies that the treatment is needed to treat chronic intractable pain. Would that accomplish what we're trying to set out to do here?
I think it would, Mr. Chairman.
You'll copy that.
Questions, Senator?
Could we get a copy of that, number one?
Get copies.
And then is the operative word or word there that means something to the course be intractable? I have a back problem from working in a welding shop that bothers me sometimes steady. I mean, it's a steady pain, but I can function. So is that's a chronic pain. So is it intractable? That is what the court would focus on, what is intractable? I guess I don't know what the definition of that word is.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, that my belief is what you just said, but not being a physician, I would hate to ascribe intractable a certain meaning that it turns out that I'm just speaking off my experience. So perhaps we should examine that. But that is the difference in my mind between chronic pain, which is something that is recurring, but intractable meaning, to me, intractable means that it's very severe.
Well, I guess I want to know the difference between intractable and debilitating. You know, what are we going for?
I take your point. I don't have a medical dictionary with me, and I think it would be what it means to a physician as opposed to what it might mean to a court, but it could ultimately turn in court, so I would never suggest that you don't consider that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Jordan's available, I'd be interested in hearing what he thinks about these.
Mr. Jordan, are you available? Mr. Jordan, are you online? From Anchorage?
Mr. Chair, this is Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Jordan, did you hear the questions?
Yeah, I heard the question. I'm not a physician, so I'm not versed in the fine nuances between intractable, debilitating, and those type of issues. But it's just my understanding that intractable means something that is just unrelenting and continuous. But that's just my knowledge. Chair.
Intractable, defined in Webster's New World Dictionary, short version, hard to manage, unruly, or stubborn.
Well,
doesn't help me.
Unruly.
Or stubborn. Stubborn, persistent, but it doesn't mean that it's debilitating.
I think that...
Let's see. Let's just move on. We'll just put this here, and it's under consideration. We'll just get a further definition here, and then let's consider number 7. Work through these.
Mr. Chairman, as I laid out yesterday, if I may. Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator French.
Page 11 of the bill, line 8, describing the job dislocation benefit and the rather significant decision that represents for injured workers, in that it is, until at least we get to a later stage in the process, an irrevocable decision and one that affects a person for a long time. It's my belief that we should make certain that that's a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of a benefit, and that is best made with the assistance of counsel. So that's the sum and substance of the amendment, is to make certain that folks who picked that job dislocation benefit have had assistance of counsel.
Comments from members? I I guess I don't have quite the same degree of concern that you do on it, Senator French. I know that people are allowed to sign contracts that affect their lives from a financial standpoint in many different ways. A standard statement that I see on many of those contracts is that the person has certified that they've either consulted with their attorney or have had an opportunity to consult with their attorney, and that they know. So I wouldn't have any problem with an amendment that would require the clear, conspicuous language on the waiver or on the form to say that by signing this, I also understand that I have had an opportunity to discuss this with counsel, and I certify that I either have discussed with counsel or had the opportunity to discuss with counsel before executing the agreement. Something in that language. We do that on many, many, many different contracts of different types in the world, and I understand that your desire to try to protect the most vulnerable. But I would think that I'm a capable person to be able to make that decision on my own and should be able to do so without having to talk to counsel. That's just kind of maybe a difference in philosophy. I understand I appreciate your concern, but I'm not sure I want to restrict everyone in the world whoever wants to make that election that they first have to talk to counsel.
Mr. Chairman, can we ask?
Senator Theriault?
How does the system currently operate, perhaps?
Mr. Lasanke?
Most people at this point, do they generally have counsel, or?
Who's buying lunch?
He's not here.
Oh. What's buying it?
Medium rare.
Yeah. So, Mr. Lasanke?
Yes, Senator Theriault, through the chair. This provision, when you're dealing with this subsection, as I track the amendment, it's talking about people who have been found eligible for benefits and need to either exercise or not exercise their eligibility. That happens currently, and there is no requirement that someone consult an attorney before they do or do not accept that benefit. So there's no change there. The only change is that they now have an alternative benefit that they would be considering at the same time. I mean, so.
So, Senator French,
That was, if I just may, Mr. Chairman, I heard Senator Theriault ask. The question I heard Senator Theriault ask was, how many of folks who get to this stage in the process have attorneys?
I guess the best answer for me to say then, Senator Theriault, through the chair, is I don't know. Because there is no requirement that they have an attorney. I'm sure that some of them may.
And for Senator French, then, what is it about the change? If people get to this fork in the road now and they have no requirement of having counsel or having consulted with counsel, what causes you to think that now they need to?
I think it's the job dislocation benefit, particularly with the fact, with respect to the fact that it assigns a strict numerical value to a percentage disability, which may vary wildly from individual to individual. And some folks, that $5,000 may be a fair sum. For some folks, it may be a dime on the dollar for what they really should be getting.
We can't assume that every one of these is a dime on the dollar deal. In some cases, it might be a dollar on the dime deal. It might be a fair settlement.
I'll give you a dime. And I don't want to get into that. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think from my perspective, this one-time buyout for a permanent partial impairment requires a degree of knowledge that most of us just don't have. What am I going to trade that permanent partial impairment for? And I think you hit on a good idea, which strikes me as a common ground, or at least a middle ground, which is not that you necessarily be represented by an attorney, but you are made aware of the fact that it might be a good idea to do so, and you know, you're busy, you can't be bothered, or you just know because your dad's a doctor and he told you that thing's worth $5,000 and it's a good deal. So for whatever reason, you're deciding to forego that opportunity. Nevertheless, it's been brought to your attention in black and white.
And I have no problem with that. I think that in terms of disclosure, when something is conspicuous under state law, that means it's in larger, bolder type and different font setting, something that would attract attention, something different than what's presented on the rest of the page.
Maybe even a little initial box there or something.
And that's fairly standard common form in terms of contracts between individuals anymore. So because it's assumed in the courts that the drafter of the document has some advantage over the person who was not the drafter, they're basically saying, you know, hey, you've read this and you've had the opportunity to allow your attorney to take a look at it before you sign it. And so I think if we were to say that the agreement contained that kind of a conspicuous statement, then I think that I would be fine with that. Mr. Lesane.
Mr. Chairman, if I could offer one clarification, one observation. The clarification is this is not a buyout of permanent partial impairment. The permanent partial impairment benefit will still be paid. This is an additional benefit which is keyed to the receipt of that underlying permanent partial impairment and the rejection of reemployment benefits. I mean, so I just want to keep it clear that this doesn't sound in the area of what permanent partial impairment benefit someone gets. They get that regardless of whether this is here or not. All it does is key an additional job dislocation benefit to the amount of permanent partial impairment benefits that you get, and it sets us, as Senator French noted, it sets a $5,000 is the lower limit and $13,500 is the higher limit. The clarification I'd like to offer is people at this phase, an injured worker is getting a notification from the Reemployment Benefits Administrator, that's the state, saying that they have been found eligible for these benefits and they now have this period of time to exercise them, reject them, and get this other benefit. I would say that there's a lot of information that's going to go out to this person. Now, whether we can posit someone who can't read or something along those lines, certainly I recognize that. But I just want to clarify that this person is not making this decision in a total vacuum, provided that they can read and can call on a telephone and ask my staff any questions they may have about the ramifications of this.
Right. And in that regard, it's a good comment. I think anytime someone is stipulating or signing any kind of an agreement in the process, what I talked about is not a bad requirement that there be there that says, look, you know, I've read it, I understand it, I know that I've had the opportunity to have my own counsel take a look at it, and they either have or I've had that opportunity and I'm willing to sign it. Now, with that in mind, I don't have any problem that person signing any agreement in the process, as long as they have had that opportunity and they know they have that opportunity to do so. I'm not going to require them to do so. You know, if you want to recraft that anyway, Senator, we'll move on here to number 8, and we can come back to this. But is that a reasonable compromise?
I think it's fair, and I just want to make sure that we capture that somehow. We don't just gloss it over.
No,
so I'm working on language.
Let's go to 8. I know that's yours as well.
This is along the same lines, and I have cleaned up the language a little bit with help from my staff this morning because it was drafted in a hurry while I was in committee yesterday. This pertains to page 12, section 19. Yeah, it pertains to section 19, and it pertains to waiver of benefits again. and it has to do with folks who are waiving future benefits, another crucial fork in the road. The way the law stands right now, those waivers go to the board, and the board reviews them. And you can see the changes envisioned by Section 19 would take that away from the board and put it in either the division or the director. It's my concern that this waiver be reviewed by someone, and it's the amendment in front of you purports to do that, and I would just make, I would restate the amendment to say this. The division may not accept a waiver executed by an employee unless the employee is represented by an attorney or the board has reviewed and approved the waiver. So you don't have to be represented by an attorney, but the board has to review the waiver and approve it. And if that happens, then I'm satisfied that there's been, you know, that someone isn't just giving up something extremely valuable. I think the board is trustworthy and won't let an injustice happen.
Lasanke?
Mr. Chairman, I want to predicate my comment by saying I was awake yesterday morning, and I'm very aware that the chairman and this committee are exercising their legislative prerogatives and don't want to hear too much about the ad hoc process or anybody else's process.
We're willing to listen to any good suggestions from anyone, Mr. Lasanke.
But I would point out that I didn't have an opportunity to make this observation yesterday when Mr. Jensen was talking on behalf of the claimant attorneys about this section. The section in the bill before you has nothing here except a change of who will make the form. Right now it says that the board will make this form that's used to waive this benefit, and the bill would have the division and the director do that. That was intended to just reflect what actually happens, because the board being volunteers does not go off for a retreat by itself and invent the form. And in fact, the division staff works up the form and then the board has approved it in the past. So this is only kind of a syntax change. Now, what was being proposed by Mr. Jensen, and now certainly Senator French can make any amendments he chooses to make. That's why people elect him. But this is something that was part of an agreement in 2000 before the legislature. And for example, the permanent partial impairment benefits were raised 31% that year, and the premiums associated with the changes in that legislation, I think Director Hall can correct me, but I believe they went up about 7.9%. This was part of a package that was agreed to after conversations and arguments about whether this form could be accepted and the waiver would then go into place, or whether it had to be with or without consultation with an attorney or a board approval or whatever. This waiver is designed for one particular purpose. Under the Act, permanent partial impairment benefits are designed to be paid in a lump sum. That's the standard. However, if someone is engaging in reemployment benefits, they're designed to be parceled out on a weekly basis. The problem that had been coming up was people saying, I don't want the reemployment benefits, then getting the lump sum of permanent partial impairment benefits, and then changing their mind and saying, now I'd like to get the reemployment benefits. That was causing a fair amount of consternation about how to coordinate these benefits. So Section 19 just reflects, with this syntax change, the agreement that was made in 2000, that if a form that had to be approved by the board so that there was full understanding of what was being entered into, executed by an injured worker that said, I am not going to pursue reemployment benefits, please give me my permanent partial impairment benefits in a lump sum. That's what this section was designed to do and continues to do to this day. I recognize that there are claimant attorneys that continue to not like that. And I certainly recognize that anyone that's elected to this body is entitled to change this provision at any time or to seek to change it at any time. But I just wanted to make the point that this is something that's relatively new, that was part of an overall agreement that the legislature put in place in 2000. And
having pontificated on that, I ask your indulgence to say one more thing, which is just that, again, there are... this was designed to be a voluntary, at the option of an injured worker, benefit. And this would take a further step that says, notwithstanding the fact that you don't even have to ask for it in the first place, you cannot let it go without consulting an attorney or having the board approve that you can let go what you don't have to ask for in the first place. And I would stand by my earlier comments that I think what we've got here gives people, strikes a reasonable balance between fully informing the person of what they're doing and allowing them to do it.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments on this? But Senator.
Mr. Chair, I would ask that Senator French, would you restate your amendment or your conceptual amendment?
It's the amendment is number 8, and the modification to it that I would propose this morning is this. The division may not accept a waiver executed by an employee unless the employee is represented by an attorney or the board has reviewed and approved the waiver. So you either have an attorney, in which case you've got excellent representation and you're making a good decision, or we'll presume you're making a good decision, or the board simply reviews the waiver and approves the waiver.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that language that intimates that you must have a lawyer disturbs me a little bit as we go along, because I don't want to sign up to the mandatory employment of anybody. And then it appears, if you just do a knee-jerk take on it, that it equates the lawyer status with the board decision-making authority as either or. That it appears to me to be a wrong message to be sending.
Okay. Let's move on, and we'll come back after we get through the first 10. We'll go back and review them. Comments. Number 9 was tabled. Can I obtain a motion to remove number 9 from the table?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that number 9 be brought back before the committee for discussion.
Objection. Hearing none, number 9 is under discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, number 9 was the one that I testified to that the Department of Law had redrafted to take out some language that was included inadvertently when the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee amended the provisions for fraud.
Redundancy?
There was a redundancy through the chair, Senatorial. Yes, it was. It was designed to delete stuff that was redundant. It was pointed out to me after I testified, however, that under the final section there, section 40, that is actually a slight change to the language that was included by the Labor and Commerce Committee. And I asked them what that was, and they said, "Well, it is designed to make clear that the punitive damages or compensatory damages are awarded by a jury in a jury trial and by the court if a matter is tried to the court alone." So they have added the words "or jury" before compensatory and punitive damages to indicate that would be the case, which depending on what type of civil action was invoked. And also they've added the language referring to AS 09.17, which I'm led to believe is the provision in the state statutes having to do with punitive damages.
Okay. Any questions about that one, Senator Terrell?
So the changed language is just really to recognize that there's two ways you can take it to the court.
Senator Terrell, through
no substantive change there, except for to realize that you could have a jury award or you could have a bench issued.
Senator, through the chair, that is the way it's been represented to me, and I would just say as just a matter of clarification that we continue to have a problem with the inclusion of punitive damages, but I don't want to beat that drum again.
You continue to have a problem with punitive damages being part of the process?
That's correct, Senator. I had mentioned that in our opening remarks, that we were, that was a change that was made in the Labor and Commerce Committee, and we recognize that, but we're still concerned about injecting punitive damages into the system.
Okay. And let's see. So, in effect, this entire new section, subsection, section 40, is one that the division believes. What reason would you have for not wanting to have punitive damages in the system?
Well, I had said, Mr. Chairman, in my opening remarks that I just wasn't aware of other workers' compensation acts that included punitive damages in some type of a civil action for, you know, things that were alleged to be fraudulent. We have very broad definition of fraud now, which we endorse and we've asked for. But just under the rule of the possible rule of unintended consequences, it just, you know, punitive damages sometimes can go in strange directions. But I don't have any further clarification of that, and I have not had an opportunity to do any in-depth research beyond my original statement.
Secretary?
So that's punitive damages in a fraudulent case, or levied against who?
Through the chair, Senatorial, anyone who's alleged to have done or said or acted in any kind of a way that falls under our broadened fraud provision in workers' compensation.
Okay, so that could be the worker.
It could.
Could be the doctor.
It could.
Could be the employer.
It could. Could be the insurance adjuster. It could be the insurance company. Or anybody. I don't know if it would extend to me if I got involved, but, you know.
So it's not a standard as far as you're concerned, or any kind of a national standard that you measure to make sure that you're awarding compensatory and punitive damages to someone who commits fraud.
Who's the victim of fraud?
Victim of fraud.
Not that I know of, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Let's look at number 10. And we're going to come back.
Mr. Chairman, if I'm following the numbering process correctly, number 10 was the provision that we asked you to include as I was making my initial remarks. This is something that the ad hoc committee had asked to be included. And basically, I would stand by my earlier remarks that what it proposes to do is to put into the statute what's actually happening currently, and also puts in a provision to avoid any later litigation about whether what I believe was an omission in an earlier omission was actually substantive, that being specifically Section 041K. Currently continues to refer back to permanent partial disability benefits, which, as I explained to the committee, since 1988, that benefit has been converted to what we now call permanent partial impairment benefits. So to avoid any litigation going forward about whether the omission of a reference to permanent partial impairment benefits was substantive, the ad hoc committee recommended that both the previous nomenclature and the current nomenclature be included.
Secretary,
unless you've got a sponsor, then I will sponsor number 10.
Okay. Let's now go back. All members of the committee are present. So we'll now look at amendment number 5. All amendments 5 through 10 are off the table and now can be considered and can be brought before the committee. Is there amendment number 5? Someone willing to propose amendment number 5?
Sponsor.
Senator Huggins, move amendment number 5.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Is there objection to amendment number 5? Oh. Senator French? Senator French, any?
Mr. Chairman, we haven't heard any information about how many cases this will affect. I think absent that sort of basic piece of information, I can't vote for this amendment, not knowing how many injured workers are going to not recover because of our adoption of this definition.
Senator Theriault?
Mr. Chairman, I think the policy call is if it's a pre-existing injury under this system, should they recover under this system? That's the issue. We have this system to cover people for injuries that they get on the job. It's a covenant between the workers and the businesses so that people are not injured at the work. The employer files bankruptcy and they get nothing. It's, you know, this deal that we've struck in our society, but we can't afford to take other pre-existing injuries, a football injury, or you were shoveling snow and wrenched your back and jam them into this system. So I guess, you know, I'm sensitive that we don't want people going without coverage or without coverage for a pain or ailment that they have, but if it's not caused at the job, should the job system pick up the expense, I guess?
Senator Huggins?
And Mr. Chair, I concur with Senator Theriault in respect. This appears to be very common sense. The average person looks at it and says it's only fair and balanced and has my support.
Sir, further discussion? Is your objection remain, Senator French?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I think the current system strikes that balance. It's a substantial factor. If it's not a substantial factor, you don't get recovery. If it is a substantial factor, then you do. And that's a common sense approach to the problem.
Clerk will call the roll, please. Oh, Senator Gass.
Thank you, Senator Sheikens. I thought a lot about this, and I appreciate you tabling it. My request, I guess, and I'll look to Paul and Linda, I'm going to vote against the amendment today, although I don't necessarily think it's a bad idea to consider, but I think if these are the types of issues that Linda brought up before that I think we should consider this interim, whoever's on this task force and those of us who might work on it this summer, because I think determining how we limit the funnel in is a good thing, but I'm not sure about the impact of these changes. I'd like to learn more about that this summer, so I'm going to vote against it, not because I think it's a bad idea, but I just think that we need to think about it a little bit more and decide how we're going to limit that funnel and make sure we do it and do it in the right way so we impact rates and take care of workers. Thank you.
Quick call the roll, please.
Senator French?
No.
Senator Huggins?
Yes.
Senator Theriault?
Yes.
Senator Guest?
No.
Yes. Amendment number 5 is passed. Amendment number 6 is the next one we'll look at. Anyone care to move amendment number 6?
Really? Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that amendment number 6 be brought forth to committee for discussion.
Senator Huggins has moved amendment number 6.
Discussion.
Senator Guess.
Mr. Chair, there's an amendment to the amendment that I guess I was the only one that was given a copy, so I'll move it so we can discuss.
Okay. Amendment to the amendment. Amendment number 6.1, we'll call it, to the amendment. As I understand it, Senator Guess, I tried to take a look up intractable. It means stubborn. I think our intent here is that this is chronic pain that would cause a person not to be able to function in their normal job functions. Senator Theriault?
I wonder if Senator Guess would consider changing intractable to debilitating, or whether I guess I think of debilitating as being it causes you not to be able to work.
Intractable to me, as I understand the word, is stubborn. I have an intractable horse or mule. More than, it's something that's hard to get rid of, I guess you might say in this case, but persistent. always there, and I'm trying to get more towards debilitating in my mind of, than I am stubborn. And so, you know, I wouldn't mind having the word intractable being replaced with debilitating, with the understanding that means this keeps a person from being able to function, to be able to work, not just uncomfortable.
Does the department want to comment on, since they had brought, you had, Paul, you had discussed debilitating, or you had discussed intractable?
Senator Guest, through the chair, I think all the committee conversation here, all the discussion is exactly what we were trying to get at, and I apologize that I wasn't able to come up with a better definition. I mean, I think that's the dilemma that I put you on the horns of. I think everyone is understanding and building an adequate record that we were thinking of intractable in the terms that I think it's sometimes used in the medical community, and it has nothing to do with stubborn, and it has to do with the people who are in so much pain that they cannot function, and maybe the degree of pain that even serious pain treatment can maybe put a dent in but cannot relieve. I mean, so debilitating, I think, would probably be the beginning of what we were thinking of. I mean, someone who is not only not working but barely staying, you know, functional as a human being. I mean, there are people in just really, really terrible pain, and that's what I was thinking of in terms of intractable, but I do not have a good definition.
And I think the intent here was not to limit us to old technologies that may be part of accepted treatment, that we, if a physician can find new technologies, say a very carefully directed pain pump of some kind to be able to address an area that might not be included in the current manuals on how you might handle some kind of a severe chronic pain, that we would not, that our intent here was not to prohibit new technology that could be of benefit to the person who is suffering chronic pain. So, Mr. Lisanki?
And I'd just like to point out, Mr. Chairman, you're right. And this is the provision that was talking about palliative care after the onset of the condition becomes medically stable, and was saying that if it was care that could get you back to work, it would be, you know, payable. And this was just almost beyond that, to just say, well, this isn't even something that you would even typically refer to as palliative because it's so desperately needed.
Right. It's something that's outside of normal palliative care. But okay, with the mover of the amendment's position, we can, without objection, change the word intractable to debilitating if that would be the pleasure of the committee. Okay, the amendment now would read, treat chronic debilitating pain. That's amendment 6.1. Is there objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment to amendment is adopted. We're now considering amendment number 6 as amended. Is there objection to the amendment number 6 as amended? Hearing none, it is passed. Amendment number 7.
Mr. Chairman, I've taken...
Senator French.
Thank you. I've taken a couple of moments to recraft this. I can sense the direction of the committee, and I'm trying to achieve something that's at least gettable. Let me see if I can rephrase this. The administrator may not accept an election to accept a job location dislocation benefit by an employee who has not signed a form which conspicuously notes the benefit being waived. That's how I would recraft amendment number 7.
Is there any objection to Senator French's rewording of amendment number 7?
Or did we take it from has not signed a form?
Senator French?
I'll say it in its entirety. The administrator may not accept an election to accept a job dislocation benefit by an employee who has not signed a form which conspicuously notes the benefit being waived.
Is there objection to Amendment Number 7, as stated by Senator French? Hearing none, Amendment Number 7 is adopted. Amendment Number 8. Senator French?
In the same vein, Mr.
Want to move the amendment, or you want to talk about it first?
I think it's been moved. I think it's been moved. But I'll, in the same vein, Mr. Chairman, try to recast this, and I'll see if I can state it.
We've discussed it without it being moved, but...
So modify it before you move it.
Modify it before
first
you
I'll
move
modify it, then I'll move it. Thank you. It's good to have folks keeping me in line. The division may not accept a waiver.
I checked with the clerk to make sure she was nodding first. But
executed by an employee unless the waiver has been reviewed and approved by the board.
Senator Theriault? Now, this is the reworded. Have you moved the amendment?
Yes. It's a reworded.
Objection? Senator Theriault.
So, from Mr. Lenzinke, so does that mean the board has to approve each one of these? Or am I mixing this up?
Well, that would be a change in the paragraph, as I understand it, because the paragraph, as I understand the way that it's crafted in the current bill that we're under, that we're considering today, just describes who is going to make the form. The form, instead of being done by the board, will be done by the staff. Is that correct? The director.
The form would be approved by the director. The division would serve the notice, and the division would receive the statement form. Those are the only changes.
So this puts a whole different spin on this entire paragraph in the statute, then. Am I correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. The operative phrase in the beginning of the current statute, which is maintained in the bill's version, is notwithstanding AS 2330.012, and that is the provision that requires the board to review and approve settlements that where employees give up rights. So it would be kind of one of the two would have to go. I mean.
Right. So you've already got that requirement.
No, it's been expressly taken out, and that's the bone of contention.
Senator Theriault.
I'm not sure then if the impact of Senator French's new wording is that it's just on a form that has been approved by the board. So is that what you're trying to get at?
No, that employee's waiver has to be approved by the board.
Mr. Chairman, I'll object.
Objection has been made. Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Huggins.
No.
Senator Theriault.
No.
Senator Getz.
No.
Senator
yes.
No. Amendment number 8 has failed. Amendment number 9.
Mr. Chairman, I'll offer amendment number 9.
Senator Theriault has offered amendment number 9. Is there objection? I will object for purposes of discussion. I kind of agree with Mr. Lasanki that I have a problem putting compensatory and punitive damages into workers' compensation law.
Mr. Chairman, can you tell us, since you're on Labor and Commerce, what the discussion was?
I don't know if this was highly discussed in Labor and Commerce as much as it was put into the committee substitute. Am I right there, Mr. Lasanka? Do you recall?
Mr. Chairman, my recollection is that there was not a great deal of discussion before it was changed.
I think it was in the committee substitute and didn't receive a great deal of attention in Labor and Commerce. But as I look at it now, I probably should have brought some more focus on it in Labor and Commerce Committee, being the vice chairman of that committee. That's probably the value of having more than one committee of referral.
Well, I guess we have just a little bit of discussion then on, you know, with the new language on fraud, what are the penalties that can be levied to bad actors?
Senator Theriault, through the chair.
There already are penalties in terms of fines and in terms of, well, there are fines and there are jail terms. But punitive damages,
yes.
And compensatory is just an additional award that's normally used for pain and suffering and a few other things. And
what this refers back to is something that I don't have a great deal of experience with, and I'm not sure anybody does. There are all the penalties that the chair just mentioned within the act, and the board, for example, can administratively require the disgorgement, the repayment of benefits that were obtained fraudulently, or payments that were obtained fraudulently. But there is currently a provision that I'm not aware of, Senator Theriault, anything taking place under it that would give me guidance to give you a clear answer. But there is a proviso in the current statute of Section 250 that says that first it lists certain things that constitute the fraud, and there's a number of them. And then it says that the people who break these rules of fraud are civilly liable to a person adversely affected by the conduct. Now, to me, that suggests that someone who's been defrauded can go to the Superior Court, file civil action, and seek a remedy there. I'm not personally aware if that has been done, and if it has been done, I am not personally aware of how it turned out or what was requested to make that person whole. So this additional Section C now would specifically lay out, in my view, that you could go for not just compensatory damages or damages that are aimed at making you whole, but also punitive damages.
I don't have any objection to compensatory damages in terms of someone getting back what they lost, but I do have a problem with punitive damages.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I figured that Labor and Commerce had discussed that at length, and I guess I'm not opposed to taking a step somehow to take that out. I guess
I would pass this amendment provided that it does not provide for punitive damages.
Is this the Section 40 the only area where the punitive damages was inserted?
Senator Theriault, through the chair, yes. As far as I'm aware of the bills proposed, that's the only area where this shows up.
Okay, so we need the modified language for Section 40 here to recognize that you could have a judge-tried or jury-tried case. So I guess if we can just come up with an amendment to the amendment here,
conceptually,
how to strike it.
Conceptually, I think if we removed on Section 40, Paragraph C, a court may provide compensatory damages and attorney's fees to prevailing file in a action under A or B of this section, and then under B, to the extent allowed by law in a civil action of this section, an award of damages by a court or jury may include compensatory damages subject to, and that, then we would not need AS 0917, which is punitive. Attorney's fees may be awarded to prevent its fall by law. I think it's almost redundant in its reading, but if we were to conceptually say that Section 40 will allow only for compensatory damages and not punitive and allow the drafter to complete that section, that may be the way we want to go. I would agree with that.
Won't you move that then,
So, Mr. Senator Guess?
Just for clarity, and I don't necessarily disagree with you, but since you're impacting a section that's not on this current amendment, should we pass this amendment and then provide a conceptual amendment to change the entire section? I guess I'm confused that what we're doing within this amendment versus, because you want to impact Section C of the bill as well, correct? Or you're amending 9 to include C?
I guess my conceptual amendment here would be...
Amendment to the amendment.
Anywhere in the statutes, we don't allow punitive damages, but that we allow for compensatory damages, and then allow the drafter to make sure that that is completed that way. So I would maybe we can handle this by saying I would amend amendment number 9 to delete the language in amendment number 9 and conceptually allow the drafter to allow for compensatory and damages and attorney's fees to the prevailing party in a civil action, but not punitive damages.
I'll object because I think there's other things going on in Amendment 9 that we need, correct? That was the redundant
right.
part?
Well, we would still pass Amendment number 9.
Yeah. So in addition to 9, okay, thank you. That's why I just wanted to make sure. So in addition to 9, we're adding on changing anywhere in the statute. Thank you. My apologies.
So 9 would include delete anything that allowed punitive damages and include anything that continued to allow compensatory damages and attorney's fees to the prevailing party. Is there any objection to that?
Question.
Amendment? Amendment? Yes, Senator French?
Question. I'm just looking at the statute as it stands right now. I guess I'm kind of going back because the bill changes the statute and then the amendment changes the statute both. And it's not exactly clear to me what we're going to wind up with when we get all done. There's two paragraphs in the existing statute. One says it's a crime to basically get benefits through fraud or misleading acts, and the other says the board may hold you civilly liable for having done so. I assume now that civil liability includes punitive damages because they're not exempted.
So our intent here was anywhere in the statute, we don't allow punitive damages.
Now.
But we do allow compensatory damages and prevailing attorney's fees to the prevailing party. Senator, Mr. Lisanki.
Mr. Chairman, Section 250, as it exists now, has A and B. A talks mostly about criminal penalties, but that is actually where the civil liability that I mentioned resides, in that little offhand remark, is civilly liable. And also criminally liable, correct, Senator French, through the chair. So B is where the board administratively can require repayment of benefits that have been derived through fraud. The board has limited its activity in that area to doing that. There has not been anyone suggest that the Alaska Workers' Compensation Statute currently gives the Workers' Compensation Board authority to award damages, punitive or otherwise.
And we're now just instructing the court that the court can, or a jury can, award compensatory damages, including attorney's fees to the prevailing party, but not punitive damages. So we're not affecting that.
Well, I want to be clear, Mr. Chairman, that I have to qualify my answer that I do not know if there have been any civil proceedings under Section 250, their outcome, for whether anyone considered punitive damages in asking the court for that. But I would agree with you that the change would be aimed at putting a constriction in the statute that authorizes those actions to say that there could not be punitive damages.
And so to make sure that we have it coordinated, that's why I'm referring it to the drafter, to make sure that it's coordinated. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number 9 is adopted. Is there objection to amendment number 9 as amended? Hearing none, amendment number 9 is passed. Amendment number 10.
I'll move amendment number 10.
Senator Terrio has moved amendment number 10. Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 10 is passed. Amendment number 11. 11 was by Senator Guess. Senator Guess, are you moving amendment number 11?
Yes, sir.
Senator Guess has moved amendment number 11. Is there objection?
I'll object for purpose of discussion.
Senator Terrio has objected. Senator Guess.
Mr. Chairman, this is the committee, and I did talk and to Paul yesterday about this and got him the amendment. I don't know what his comments will be on it. This was trying to balance what, you know, this new dislocation benefit, and it was meant to do two things. One, go from 15 days to 30 days, only to give people a little bit more time to respond, I mean, under oath on a form provided and all that, just because life sometimes, you know, takes us for a loop, and so I was trying to go from the 15 to the 30 to give people a little bit more time to make the decision. More importantly on this, the bulk of the amendment is to allow that injured worker within 1 year of saying, yes, I'll take the dislocation benefits, to say, you know, I made a mistake. I thought I could go back to work and I didn't need relocation benefits, that this would, that this was the right decision for me, and say, it was a wrong decision for me, I'm going to pay back the money I got, the $5,000 or $3,500, and I'm going to go back to relocation benefits. Because I really wasn't able to go back to work the way I thought I was. So I was trying to strike a balance of what we heard here and, you know, making these decisions and not being able to say, you know, I made a mistake on it. So that was the thought and the intent behind this amendment.
Mr. Lesanke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I did appreciate Senator Guess discussing this with me and giving me an opportunity to think about it, which I promised to do and which I did. I'd like to break it into the two components. Changing the bill from 15 days to 30 days, again, going back a little bit to the history of it, in 2000, up until 2000, it was 10 days to make, to indicate your choice to go forward with the benefit, and it was expanded to 15 days in 2000. Obviously, there's no magic period of time that makes a decision right or wrong, or gives somebody just enough time and not too much time. And I don't want to focus too much of my comments on that. I mean, it is true that now there is one more thing, one more factor for the person to consider that they didn't have to consider before, but it's pretty much the same question. So if the committee feels that someone needs a little more than 15 days, I mean, 15 or 30 days is not a very great expansion. I had more trouble, obviously, with the idea of leaving a decision unresolved for a year, kind of, or not unresolved. It appears to be resolved for a year, but you're never really quite sure whether the resolution took or not. And I certainly accept Senator Guess's representation that this is very much a middle ground to require someone to actually pay something back to get the opportunity to go forward in the future is something we've never done before. So that is, I think, a very moderate stance. But I guess the thing that tilts it for me is just administratively, I could see it being very difficult, just not just for the division, but for the insurance companies or for the self-insured employers, of just want, you know, having this resolved but not truly resolved benefit for a period of a year. And reluctantly, I don't think I can support the change that would, you know, essentially allow someone to undo their choice for a period of a year after everybody in the system thought that they knew what the answer was.
So any effect there from an insurance standpoint that you can think about?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sitting here as I'm listening to Senator Guess and Director Lesanke. The consideration that I would see from an employer standpoint, a approximately, the major number of employers who have premiums in excess of $5,000, I'll use as a breakoff, are subject to something called experience rating, and that is their own individual claims experience, and it is either credited or debited on top of their typical insurance premium. If they have a good claims experience, they get a credit. If they have bad, they get penalized. That information is done on prior year's experience, or if you had a change in a claim, which this I think could do, while you would repay a piece, but you might have a greater retraining expense, it could change that, and I really don't know how that would affect that calculation. It's a very technical calculation, but I don't have any, I have no experience at doing that, so it just, it could have a potential effect there.
Senator Terrio?
For Mr. Lisenki, is your concern partially based on the length of time, or just the mechanism at all?
It is only partially based on the length of time. The mechanism, as Director Hall indicates, I mean, this is something that's so new to us. It would be something completely new. And there's nothing wrong with doing things new. It's just it makes it hard to have an informed opinion about what all the ramifications would be. But that's kind of an elliptical answer to a straight question. I apologize.
And the way the system works right now, I mean, if it's an inducement for somebody to take the benefit, go back to work, you know, give it a try, see if it works, see if you're able to perform your job, and you know, get on with your life. But if it's determined that you've tried to get back to work and you know, you can step back and undo it, I can see that might be an inducement for somebody to get out there. But I guess that's based on the premise that they're not back at their job. And really, the way the system works, while this is all going on, they may be getting treatment for their back or whatever, and really be back at the job already. Yes, no, or...
Senator Terrio, through the chair, that's true. But the entitlement to the benefit that is being given up is premised on the inability to go back to your job. That's the anticipation in evaluating whether you're entitled to this benefit. If you've gone back to your job, you are not eligible.
Have gone back to
you. I'm thinking back, this mechanism is one that's been used in the retirement system, and I was just listening to some stories, some very interesting stories about people who came back in after 20, 25 years, paid their money back, and worked one day and retired again because they found out there was huge economic benefit to them to do that. it was not to the benefit of the PERS-TERS system or to the people of the state of Alaska, but it was to the individual at that particular time. And so I have kind of a natural aversion to the mechanism when I see what it costs us. I don't know what this would cost us in terms of trying to actualize for that. You'd set that reserve aside somehow or another. Are you aware of this mechanism being used anywhere else in workers' comp insurance?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not personally aware of a system quite like this that I know of, but I did not have an opportunity to do a great deal of research since I discussed it.
But there is. Have you ever heard of it? Ms. Hall?
No, Mr. Chairman, I have not. Okay. But I would agree, I have not ever asked either. So,
I have no objection to the waiting 30 days either. I mean, 30 days versus 15 doesn't hurt, even though we're always trying to shorten the time frames in everything that we do. If that was what it took for someone to make a reasoned decision and have the opportunity to discuss it with counsel or with rehabilitation specialists or whoever they wanted to, if it took that amount of time for them to make a reasoned decision, I don't particularly object to the additional 2 weeks.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Paul a question? I mean, it is new, and maybe it is not the correct, maybe it's not the way workers' comp is done. I don't think it's necessarily bad policy. But we're putting a whole new benefit in that we don't know the impact of, this job dislocation benefit. And so I was more responding to that because we're doing something we don't know about. And someone's going to make a decision they don't know about, and you know, you can't back up from that. And I guess, can you explain to us again why we're doing a job dislocation benefit at all? Because it seems as if someone needs reemployment, they need reemployment. And that's what reemployment is there for. And why are we doing a job dislocation benefit instead of just saying, if you need reemployment, we're going to give you reemployment. And if not, then you don't need reemployment. We're not going to give you cash. We're not going to give you anything else.
Senator Guest, through the chair, I mean, that's a good question. I think it's a reflection that the way that your entitlement to reemployment benefits is laid out in the statute is admittedly, it can't possibly be structured to every individual's case. I mean, there have to be general rules. And there are some people who are found eligible that don't really need it. And there are some people that might not be found eligible who might need some assistance. And so I think that the job dislocation benefit was a recognition of that and saying, well, if someone needs a little bit of help and they choose that over going through the system, or if someone is afraid that they're not going to get anything and they can get a little something, that's the way we'll try and bridge that. But the foundation of your question, I think, is very well put, that if you know that somebody cannot go back to work without retraining, then that's what we should try and do.
This is Senator Dario. You had a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd move to divide the question. Separate out the 30 days from the second portion.
So you're talking about from line 18 on page 1?
Well, is that 11A would be lines, page 1, lines 1 through 3, and page 1, line 18 through page 2, line 16. But it's
number, yeah, just divide
pretty them. Easy to encapsulate right. The two sections that are the 30-day.
All right.
As 11A.
11A would be, where would it be again? Go ahead.
We
got
days.
One through.
Yeah, everything dealing with the 30 days.
Okay. Is there objection to that? Let's take a look at 11A. We've moved to divide the question, and we now have for us consideration for movement for 11A. I'll move 11A. For the record, is there objection to 11A on the 30-day question? Hearing none, 11A is adopted. Senator Guest, that remains 11B. I will move 11B. Is there objection to 11B?
Mr. Chairman, I'll object.
Further discussion on 11B? Clerk, Senator French.
One aspect of 11B that I don't think has been articulated is the reason why I'm going to vote for it, and that's because I see it being used extremely rarely. I think it's extremely unlikely that an employee who has undergone a permanent partial impairment has taken a cash payout, has used that money to keep his family afloat, is going to turn around suddenly later on and come and pay the system back. I think that's highly unlikely. But I do see it as a potential savings clause, if you will, for someone who realizes they've gotten a really bad deal and that what they really need to do is get retrained, and that the $5,000 they took for a permanent partial impairment for 15% is going to nowhere begin to get them through the next 20 or 30 years of their working life. So I think in those rare instances where the system has worked a great injustice, Senator Guest's good idea will serve to correct that.
Further discussion? Senator Terrio?
Well, Mr. Lanzini said that part of his concern was over the length of time. If it's a shorter length of time, is he still has the overall concern on the mechanism, or?
Yes.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Terrio?
No.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Guest?
Yes.
Chair Stephens?
No, 11B has failed. Senator Guest, I think this would be a good item for discussion during, for the task force. Number 12, as you all know, is the conceptual amendment that was talked about in Labor and Commerce. I'll move 11-12. Is there objection to number 12? And I'll object to it myself for just discussion purposes. This is, Mr. Lasanki, as I understand it, there's been no complaint that you are aware of there being a conflict of interest of this type?
I have not heard complaints along these lines, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any objection to this amendment, the division, an opinion on it one way or the other?
I stand by my earlier statements, which is we're certainly not carrying a flag for any conflict of interest.
Anything from the Division of Insurance? None. I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Amendment number 12 is passed. Adopted. We have Chris Knutson online from the Department of Law, who, and Chris, I apologize. The chairman apologizes because I know you're there to answer questions, but the chairman came from a large family and has a large family and is used to being interrupted when someone needs to get his attention. So with that in mind, I know you have some questions to answer on Senate Bill 130. So if you would put your name on the record for us and give us your comments.
Thank you very much, Senator, Chairman. I apologize that the questions had to do with Amendment number 9, which has passed with the draft of comment. The only thing that I would note for the record is that Section 0917 refers not just to punitive damages, but to how compensatory damages may be apportioned as well. I think that what I would propose to the drafter to comply with the intent of the committee in passing number 9 is to delete the word "and punitive."
Yeah, that's what
I would do. We will work with the drafter on that. We appreciate that, Chris. Thank you for your help today. And if you see us stumbling along where you can assist us, please feel free to interrupt us.
Thank you very much.
Chairman would now like to have about a 3-minute recess. Back on the record. Let's see, we have gone now. Before we get started, I want to introduce, for the benefit of the committee and for those that are in attendance, I have two visitors here today who I'll introduce later in the session, but I'll introduce them to you. My daughter, Beth, and her husband, Paul Austin, who are here visiting. Beth graduated from UAF. Last year, and Paul is graduating this year. Paul is Beth in marketing. Paul has getting a degree in mechanical engineering and petroleum.
Mechanical
with petroleum emphasis. Paul played 4 years of hockey with the University of Alaska Fairbanks hockey team. Now he's retired from that and just taking care of the farm for my wife and I while we're down here. Good to have you with us. Okay. So we've gone through 12 amendments. Senator French, do any of the members have specific amendments that they would like to consider at this point in time?
I've got one, Mr. Chairman, and that is this one here. Here's enough copies for the committee and for the folks in the audience.
This would be amendment number 17. If I'm correct, am I correct, Madam Clerk? French, do you offer this amendment?
I'll move amendment number 17, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection? Have objection from the chair for purposes of discussion.
Mr. Chairman, this simple little amendment would refer to a report that's going to be prepared. If you'll refer to page 28 of the bill. Lines 8 through 13 refer to the Medical Services Review Committee study and report. As the bill is currently written, the Medical Services Review Committee will prepare to proceed to study medical and related benefits provided under this section and chapter to determine the appropriateness, et cetera, and prepare a report by March 1, 2007, and provide to the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development a report of the results of the study. This amendment would move that date up by about 2 months to the first week of the first regular session of the 25th Alaska State Legislature, that's 2007, and make certain that that report is provided not only to the Commissioner, but to the Legislature. So it would move it up 2 months and provide the report to the Legislature and to the Commissioner. That's the sum and substance of amendment number 17.
Further discussion? Senator French, you've been reading my mind earlier this morning. I talked to Mr. Lisanki about making sure that that report was brought to the legislature, looking at the structural method of being able to do so. I hate it when you read my mind.
It's scary, Mr. Chairman.
I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number 17 is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Guest.
There was, and I did not write it up, but we discussed it, and I forgot we had discussed it, and to come back to it, on page 28, line 12.
Page 28, line 12.
Regarding the study that the Medical Services Review Committee is going to do, I had talked to the administration and discussed earlier with the committee putting delivery after necessity. It seems as if it's not only the appropriateness, necessity, and cost of the benefits, but also the delivery system of benefits that needs to be looked at. How are we delivering benefits within the medical community?
Are you proposing an amendment, Senator Guest?
So I would move to amend to put delivery after necessity.
Amendment number 18, as moved by Senator Guest, would insert on line 12, page 28, the word after the word necessity, comma, the word delivery, comma. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 18 is adopted. Further amendments from members of the committee at this point?
Mr. Chair,
I'd
like to bring up, and I know we were discussing it offline a little, I'm thinking more about it. Can we go back to a discussion about amendment number 2 from yesterday?
Let's do one thing first. Let's, before we do that, the chair would entertain an amendment on line page 15, line 12, to change the word prescribing to attending.
Are you making that
yes,
motion?
Yes, that's a motion from the chair.
That would be amendment 19?
Number 19.
And the impact?
It basically puts it in compliance with the definition of attending physician in the bill. Amendment number 19, is there objection? Hearing member 19 is adopted. Senator Guest, we're going to revisit amendment number 2.
Mr. Chair, when we discussed amendment number 2 yesterday, it's always good and humbling to admit when you were wrong. For me, I thought, wrong in this way, I thought that we were discussing just on who could prescribe medication and that we were covering everyone that we could prescribe medication. I didn't know we were changing the definition of attending physician throughout the chapter, and that's my fault. For not being more on top of it yesterday. I am concerned with section F, that it's the only place that we put a qualifier on a provider. And I'm concerned about moving it out in such a way to finance. This is a hard enough bill to try to get through, let alone to deal with the politics and policy that might follow it to finance, given everything that's on their plate. So I'd like to at least have a discussion about whether or not we should...
Mr. Sankey, can... This is, of course, is a this suggestion is a mirror of the law from the state of Oregon, as I understand it. Could you discuss the history of how the limitation is placed on chiropractic visits at the moment? Are you familiar with that?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. In 1988, the legislature was confronted with the possibility of limiting certain types of medical care in terms of frequency. And so the upshot of the legislative session in 1988 was statutory authority that was given to the Workers' Compensation Board, which was authorizing them to address certain types of treatment, which were described as a course of treatment requiring continuing and multiple treatments of a similar nature. And that has typically been viewed as covering things like physical therapy, chiropractic, and certain other healthcare treatments such as that. So the board, having been given that authorization to come up with standards for treatment frequency, cast a regulation which has been on the books since shortly after 1988, and the regulation talks in terms of how many treatments can be given in the first per week in the first month, and how many treatments can be given in the second and third months, and it peters out over a period of 12 months. And there is a safety valve as far as the frequency that says that if a treatment plan is put in at early enough, and if the treatment plan adequately explains why the treater needs to exceed the frequency, that the board may allow more frequent treatments. So that's the way it was put in place in 1988. But there was no distinctions drawn between, in terms of whether a physician, or rather whether a chiropractic physician would be, could be an attending physician or not.
Okay. As I would read the amendment, as applied to the statute, it would appear to me that at the end of 30 days or 12 visits, whichever occurs first, that in order for the chiropractic treatment to continue, there would have to be a referral. Am I reading that the same way you would interpret it?
That would be my reading, Mr. Chairman, based on the reference to attending physician being changed for purposes of Section 095A and B.
So if a chiropractor then, in collaboration with an osteopath or an allopath, a medical doctor, were to say, you know, Harry, I've got this patient, he or she's coming along, but needs additional help, I'm at the end of my statutory authority to act by myself, I need a referral, and the doctor, the medical doctor, said, we're referring this client to you to continue for such a period of time. That would be an acceptable practice as you would view the statute at this time, then?
That would be my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
Secretario?
Mr. Chairman, the concern that I have with that is just this tension between the MDs and the chiropractors, and I'm not sure if the board has the ability through regulations, the power through regulations to rein in a particular course of care that they see abuse in. Isn't that enough?
Thank you.
Senator Terrio, through the chair. I believe it was viewed as enough in 1988.
when this difficult area was addressed. And the board, it is true, as your question suggests, that the board could revisit its regulations if it felt the necessity to do so, if it felt that the current regulations were for some reason either allowing too much care or not allowing enough.
Senator Terrio?
I think that's how I prefer to handle it, to tell you the truth.
I think, I know that Dr. Pfeiffer, who is a chiropractor, has indicated he'd like to testify, and I do have an email from him. We are running against the clock to finish all the rest of the stuff that we have before us. I know we could leave it to the Finance Committee to handle because we've done most of the heavy work for them. And I promised them that I would before it got to them. But I would say if we were to change that for at this point in time to be for a period prescribed by period and frequency prescribed by regulation. Licensed chiropractor.
Mr. Chairman, would that be necessary because you already have the power to prescribe these periods or limitations for anybody that's on the list, don't you?
We're just putting that in as the definition. So that is there. But I don't know whether we want to put that on there for make that an emphasis that this is a decision to be made on by them or not.
Well, does your current regulatory power applies to everybody? Correct.
It applies to types of treatment.
All types of treatments.
It applies to those limited treatments that are described in the statute as recurring and similar. I'm sorry, the language always eludes me, but it's a limited set of treatments that qualify for board regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And chiropractic treatment is one of the treatments that's conceived of as falling under that authority.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Secretary,
I'm not sure why we would need to restate it here.
Well, I don't have a problem at this point just saying a licensed chiropractor.
Period.
But I would say that the chiropractor should be on notice that this is one area that more than likely the task force is going to examine, is in the area of similar repeated. What do you call
them? I found the statute again because I can never recall it, Mr. Chairman. I've been reading this for 17 years. Continuing and multiple treatments of a similar nature.
I think this is one of the areas that I most frequently hear from people is an area where we could control costs effectively, and it will probably have a magnifying glass on it during the task force process. I don't have any problem changing it for now for the purposes of getting this bill out of committee. But with everybody who's involved at that level, whether they're allopaths or chiropractors or osteopaths or dentists or whomever, that is one of the areas that will probably receive a great deal of attention during the task force process. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we rescind our action in adopting Amendment Number 2.
Is there objection? Hearing none, Amendment Number 2 is rescinded. Senator Terrio?
I move an amendment to Amendment Number 2, that is on page 1, lines 12 and 13. Delete the language right after the F parentheses. Strike it all down to the comma after occurs.
Okay, so it would read F would mean read F a licensed chiropractor. Is there objection? Hearing none. Amendment Number 2, as amended, is passed, or is proposed.
The amendment to the amendment is passed. Now, bringing back the amended amendment.
Now, Senator Terrio?
Move the amended amendment.
Senator Terrio has moved the amended amendment. Is there objection? Hearing none, the amended amendment Number 2 is passed. Did we do that correctly, Madam Clerk?
Yeah.
Thank you. Check with the expert. Have we completed the amendments that are proposed by the members? We have several more that we can just take a quick look at. Let's look at Amendment Number 13.
Four more, so.
Right. That's what I have, too, I think. You don't, but they're not yours, right?
No.
Senator Ontario.
If they're not hers, they're not mine, they're nobody's at this table, they don't exist.
Right. For benefit of discussion, I will move these amendments just to keep peace in the family here.
Okay.
But let's look at Amendment Number 13, and I'll move that one. Amendment Number 13, who did you want to speak to that one? Gentlemen, did you want Mr. Jordan to speak to that? I don't think he's available still, is he?
If not, I don't think it's necessary to speak to it.
Okay. Is Mr. Jordan still online in Anchorage? I'm taking that as a no. I heard a cough or somebody clearing their throat, but that must be a no.
Mr. Chairman, this is Kristen Knudsen, FBLIO in Anchorage. Mr. Jordan is no longer present at the FBLIO, and we believe he may be listening on the phone.
Okay, let's just take a quick look. This amendment, I've moved the amendment, and for purposes of discussion, we'll take a look at on page 15. This would delete sections 24. Lines 10 through 31. And page 16, delete section 24, lines 1 through 7. Or 25, 1 through 7, I'm sorry. 17. Well, I don't know, these numbers aren't adding up for me.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's either they meant to delete all section 25, which we need to do the second part on page 16, or they meant to delete lines 2 through...
That's correct. It meant to delete all of 24.
But all of 25 as well, or just sections...
Let me just take a look through,
okay.
Through 7.
It's all 24.
All of 24.
Right, both pages.
5, 1 through 27.
25 is the problem.
1... Lines 1 through 27.
1 through 27, or it's...
I think the intent of this amendment is to get rid of the generic drug product, the drug list, the cookbook, and the presumptions. And the fees. I think, so just on the record, that's a broad amendment.
Basically all of section 24 and all of section 25. Is that the way we understand the amendment?
So this was proposed through the Alaska State Medical Association. Is there a discussion on the amendment? None. Clerk, call the roll.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but the amendment says one thing, and what we've put on says another.
Right.
The amendment in front
amendment
of us...
should read. Now, let's put it this way.
Okay.
The amendment should read that we'll delete all of 24 and all of 25. The discussion. Senator, Mr. Lisanki.
Mr. Chairman, I hesitate to get involved in your interpretation, but number 14 talks in terms of change, making a change to section 25. So I think that Senator Guess's observation about perhaps their intention was to leave the first part of section 25 and take out the second part, maybe.
What I'm trying to figure out.
Do we know exactly how that read?
Is it page, line 2?
Both sections. Okay. And if that failed, they're coming back with number B.
I stand corrected.
Let's call the roll on the amendment number 13, which would
hold on, Mr.
Chairman. Would delete sections 24 and 25.
I'm going to move to divide this. And let me just tell you why, because... subsection N, for example, on page 15, lines 11 through 17, are about generic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, actually, it's got generic drugs, and then it's got preferred drug list. And I think generic drugs are a good idea. I'm not sure about preferred drug list, or at least I think that's addressed later on in amendment number, what we have marked as amendment number 16. There's some discussion of preferred drug list. Guess I'm groping for a way to maintain mandate for generic drugs. I think that's, most people would agree, that's a good way to save money.
Okay. So you've divided the question.
It may be easier for me just to come back. It may be easier for me just to come back at the very end and reinsert that, because it looks to me like it's...
Is there support for the amendment? Anybody want to speak in support of it? Call the roll, please.
Amendment 13. Senator Guess?
No.
Senator French?
Pass.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Terrio?
No.
Senator French?
No.
No. Amendment 14. I'll propose Amendment 14. This amendment, and I'll object to it for purposes of discussion myself, this amendment would effectively keep the current rates for medical treatment rather than rolling it back 1 year. Discussion?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Mr. Kelly? Basically, what happens now is... Mr. Kelly, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tim Kelly, representing the Alaska State Medical Association. Now that we've gotten rid of Amendment 13, Amendment 14 would effectively change the date of the schedule used for the payment of medical fees and from December 15, 2003, which is in the current committee substitute, which is the fee schedule that was paid in 2004. It would move it up to basically, it would freeze rates at current rates right now, 2005 rates. That rate schedule was established on December 15, 2004. So basically, from the point of view of the medical community, a freeze is freezing current rates as they exist right now. Anything going back to current rates is a rollback. So it would institute a freeze at current rates as opposed to the rollback that's in the committee substitute of 2003. And that is the extent of the amendment.
Discussion? Questions? Mr. Lisanki, does the division have a position?
Mr. Chairman, I would reiterate that there is that problem with using the December 15th if you stay with 2003, because we don't have one that was established on that date.
And what would be the default?
We want in effect as of December 13th.
You could put in effect as of December 15th if you wanted to do that.
So regardless of where we put it, we have to change it in effect rather than dated. Am I correct?
Because it was July 1, 03 when it was actually adopted.
So the question is, do you want to use the rates that were in effect in 04 or the rates that are in effect today? And what originally was proposed by the administration was the rates in effect in 1999, which was a little draconian. Or in 2000, I'm sorry. Senator Guess.
Mr. Chair, we need a motion to remove dated and put in effect.
Yes. Well, we still have to, if we vote this down, we still have to have an amendment to amend the bill to say dated. So if we vote this amendment down, we still have to come back and change the original bill to say dated. Am I correct there, Mr. Lusanki?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and actually I believe that our 2004 was December 1 rather than December 15th, just to add to your difficulties.
Okay. So what do you want to do with this amendment? Do you want to pass this amendment and correct the dates? I mean, if this doesn't pass, we'll go back and correct the dates anyhow. If you want to pass this one, we can correct it in the amendment. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm going to speak for the amendment and for two reasons. One is, every time we restrict payments or within the healthcare system, it seems just a cost shift. So it's going to end up somewhere else anyway. And since we have the task force that's going on this summer, it seems like this is one of the issues that they should address because of the unintended consequences of the entire healthcare system, which it may impact that we don't know by making this. If we were only going to deal with this bill once in my, or this topic once in my tenure, I might feel differently, but we're not, and I always worry about, we cut over here, and then where are those costs going to pop up, and it's normally on me and my insurance, since I am fortunate enough to be insured. So I think at this point, it's good to make them at the current rates and deal with it at a later time.
Does an insurance have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my only comment will be one of the reasons for looking at the workers' compensation system was to find ways to address costs to impact premiums. And as we continue, for valid reasons, to look at a variety of things. You used the word draconian, and I know that was certainly an impression. I used the dreaded M word one day, and I'm concerned that we're going to end up with another year of nothing that has a cost impact, which translates in the division of insurance to not starting to at least slow the rate of premium increase for our employers.
So, Mr. Chairman, have we changed the language there as a technical change so it would be bulletin in effect on December 15th? Or do we need to move that as an amendment to the amendment?
I think if you want to amend this amendment and pass this amendment, that's the place to do it.
Well, we should be voting on what we know is correct language. So,
if I understand, Senator, you're proposing an amendment to the amendment number 14 that would say publish bulletin in effect on December 1st, 2003.
Yes.
Is there objection to the amendment to the amendment? Hearing none, that amendment to the amendment is adopted. Further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Senator French?
No.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Cherry?
No.
Senator Guest?
Yes.
Senator
Chairman? No. Chair would entertain a motion to on line 15, page 16, which would be amendment number.
So moved.
20. Amendment number 20 would change on line 15 the word dated to in effect and the date from December 15th to December 1st, 2003. Amendment number 20, is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 20 is adopted. Amendment number 16 is a long amendment. Is there anyone who would like to propose amendment number 16?
I have 15 in front of me.
I'm sorry. I had it on top of the other one. 15 is the little note in the upper right-hand corner was taken care of by Senator French's amendment. Is there someone who would like to sponsor Amendment Number 15?
Through 30.
And Mr. Lesenke, I would ask you a question at this point before we do that. When we talk about the guidelines for treatment, are we at a point in your mind where we have, which are on page 15, section 24, are we at a point in your mind where we could say that a scope of treatment that is not included in this American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine's Occupational Medicine Practices Guidelines, that if it's not there, that would not be reason for an insurance company to deny the treatment?
I don't think that there's, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that there's anything in the substance of the text that indicates that clearly.
Would you feel more comfortable, since I think that's probably the intent of the committee, I'm not speaking for the whole committee, if we were to add that verbiage to this section to make sure that it's an application or medical treatment that's not included in that manual cannot be, that could not be reason for denial of the claim? Or
I would be more comfortable that it be clearly understood that the guidelines be interpreted as they are written, and if they did not consider a treatment, that the fact that they did not consider it not be held as a basis for denying that treatment. That's correct.
Okay.
Mr.
Yes?
I think we addressed this Amendment 3 yesterday.
Did it pass as a 3?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that we're comfortable with that fact.
Okay. And I believe you're correct in all of the amendments. I lost track of the fact that this is had been adopted as number 3.
Okay. So we're comfortable with number 3 at this point in time. And I want to make it very clear on the record then that we don't get to that point. Are you comfortable there, law, insurance, workers' comp?
I am.
Ms. Hall?
Yes.
Thank you.
Chris Hansen from the LIO, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
Okay. So we have liftoff on that one then. Let's take a look at 15.
You were drawing the amendment.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr.
15. We're withdraw. 16. Does anyone want to sponsor that amendment? This one sets a long process in place. I would actually think that this would be a process that we may want to take further look at on a task force. There's no sponsor for the amendment. We'll assign that to the task force as part of their duty for the summer. Are there further amendments to bring to the bill? I would like to go back and revisit the amendments, the task force amendment. Which one is that?
The first one. With a complete one for some reason.
For purposes of discussion, before I go any farther.
It's number 1, Mr. Chairman?
Correct. I would like to expand the membership, the legislative membership, to this bill. To one member from the minority to be determined by the Speaker and the President, a nomination from the minority. I do believe Senator Guest has a good point that we should, in this process, make sure that we have not that we consider because I believe, for an example, I believe the amount of, the depth of understanding and the hard work from the minority on this committee on this bill is a good example of how we can work together towards a product that can meet the needs of both the employers and the employees in the state. I particularly appreciate the fact that Senator French and Senator Guest have been hard workers on this bill and other bills, and I particularly think the economist background that Senator Guest has could be a very strong addition to the task force as we go forward. I'm not trying to name her to that committee. It's not my responsibility. I'm just using it as an example. And so I would like to go back and look at Amendment Number 1 to include one member shall be a state senator appointed by the president of the Senate, one member shall be a representative, and at least one other member, or at least and one other member should be appointed by agreement between the Speaker and the Senate President to be a minority. Senator Theriault.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we rescind our action in adopting Amendment Number 1.
Is there objection? Amendment Number 1 is rescinded.
Mr. Chairman, I move a conceptual amendment to the amendment that would add language making it clear that a member of the minority is to be selected jointly by the Speaker and the President and serve on the task force and be an additional member.
Is there objection? Hearing none, that conceptual amendment, Amendment Number 1 as amended, is passed.
The amendment to the amendment passes.
Amendment to the amendment passed.
Now I move the amended
amendment. The amendment has been moved. Is there objection?
We should increment these.
Yes, and we'll increment the numbers of members as well. Is there objection? Hearing none. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll go on record as saying that Senator Guest should be burdened with that responsibility.
Well, I truly do.
By acclamation, Mr. Chairman.
I truly do appreciate the fact that the minority members of this committee work hard and are good contributors. So that helps me as a chairman tremendously. We have before us the amended version of Senate Bill 130. CS for Senate Bill Number 130, Labor and Commerce, Version G, as amended. Further discussion by the members? The will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Version Golf, as amended, with individual comments, fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved on to the next committee of referral. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for your hard work.
Sorry for sliding that.
We're done.
I don't have those. I didn't get 3 and 4 yet.
Okay, so where's my 3?
I'll have it. Not me. I don't have any.
Did you adjourn? I am going to adjourn the committee.